Welcome to Open Minds, a Freedom of Thought podcast series, interviewing the people who bring courage and independent thought to the challenges of today.
Hello, Ryan Newman. Welcome to the Freedom of Thought podcast.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. So, your early life, you were born in New Mexico, grew up in New Mexico, college at West Point.
That's right.
5 years of service in the Army, and then the kind of very successful career that some in the conservative legal movement are sort of privileged to have, right? Very distinguished career of series of clerkships, including Justice Alito, Jones Day, some Capitol Hill, served in the Trump administration, including Office of Legal Policy, and now general counsel to Governor DeSantis.
That's right. Well, my wife, you know, is desperate to get me to figure out what I want to do for a living.
Serving sort of the thanks of a grateful nation, don't necessarily sort of,
right.
Yeah. Gainful employment is nice too. But especially in your current role, you've really been involved in some of the most interesting policy work involving freedom of thought in the country. And I think changed the conversation on the role of the state in preserving freedom, and preserving freedom of thought and conscience, speech. So just to back up a bit, I am very interested in the connection between your life and thought. So, like I say, some aspects of your career are very typical for kind of high success conservative legal movement. I'm not sure, I think you're the first Freedom of Thought podcast interviewee to have gone to West Point and served in the military. So how did that happen growing up? What did you want to do? Was that part of the culture in your family?
No, actually not at all. In fact, we don't really have a history of service in my family. And I guess, you know, this is a Freedom of Thought podcast. Most people don't think of the military as a place where freedom of thought, flourishes. Obviously, it's a very regimented lifestyle. I had always wanted to go, though, into the Army ever since I was little. Just had a really strong and passionate sense of patriotism and felt that, you know, military service was the highest form of patriotism and service to your country. And so I just always had a really strong urge to do that. And, you know, like any young boy, I was really into Army things. And I think my parents thought that that it was just a stage, you know, a boyhood stage that would quickly pass. Next thing they knew, they were dropping me off at West Point. But at some level, though, I grew up in the West, you know, and so when people think of the West, they think of freedom, you know, and a resilience. You think of the, you know, and Southeast New Mexico, which is where I'm from, is oil and gas country, you know, so people are really independent spirited out there. And the oil business has always been kind of known for, you know, its booms and its busts. You know, being independent-minded, independent-spirited, not needing anybody to get ahead, you know, just work hard and tank your lumps when they come, but not looking for any handouts. You know, that's the kind of mentality, I think, that prevailed, at least where I grew up in Southeast New Mexico, and I know that's certainly the values my parents raised me with. So that also, I think, gives me a bit of a contrarian nature, too. You know, I kind of buck at, you know, oppressive ideologies, or, you know, just buck at the notion that, you know, these are the way that things have to be or that you have to think. So there is a bit of a dichotomy there, because on one hand, yeah, I spent a lot of my life in the military, not exactly a place known for its freedom in that sense. But then I also come from a part of the country, though, that I think values that independent-minded spirit. And I think that's kind of what has brought me to where I'm at, kind of in the political world.
Were your parents Are your parents politically independent? Did they instill that or encourage that kind of contrarian?
Not overtly.
Streak?
I mean, they're very religious. So I grew up in a very Christian background, and so my parents were always, you know, conservative in how they lived their life.
That has a bit of a countercultural.
Well, these days it certainly does.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Although it really didn't seem like it. In the world where I grew up, certainly, you know, relative to the country at large, that is absolutely true.
Right.
But it's not as though we talked about politics growing up. We really didn't. But I do have distinct memories of having a very politically conservative worldview growing up. And I remember, you know, I was in high school in 1992 when Bill Clinton was elected, and I was just so disgusted at the thought that our country would ever elect a draft dodger to be president of the United States. And I was just disgusted by that. But at the time, I was more focused on military things than politics at the time. Although, yeah, I had some interest.
Was West Point sort of what you expected it to be? I hear it's a bit of a tough slog.
It was good for me because it forced me to, you know, transcend what I thought I was capable of in a lot of ways, and I kind of needed that, and so it was a great builder of character for me. The interesting thing is when I went to West Point, I thought that I was going to make the military a career. You know, and I was thinking I wanted to be a general, you know, I wanted 4 stars and all this sort of thing. That's kind of the mindset I had going in to West Point. But one thing that's interesting about the West Point curriculum is it's very broad based, and students don't get a lot of discretion in the courses they take, especially for the first 2 years. It is a set curriculum, and you take, you know, philosophy, political science, American history, chemistry, physics, and so forth. But one of the required courses at West Point is also the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which wouldn't be a surprise, but also constitutional law. And so I took a constitutional law class at the academy that's required for all cadets. And that was my real first exposure, because I'm not from a family of lawyers either. That was my first real exposure to law. And I loved it. I just thought it was so fascinating. We explored, you know, the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, you know, all, and it was my first real exposure to all of that. And that really planted the seed in my mind about going to law school one day, and probably actually set me on a course to leaving the military altogether, which was not my plan going in. But once I was exposed to that class, political science, politics, that sort of thing, I kind of got a bug that I think would eventually draw me away from the military and into a more of a legal political world.
What did your parents do?
So my dad was a realtor, and my mom was a school teacher. Although for much of my growing up years, she was, a stay-at-home mom. She didn't go into the classroom until much later.
And so then when you left West Point and were just serving in the Army, when you left West Point, did you have the idea at that time that you might find your way to law school?
I did, yeah. By the time I left West Point, I was thinking, look, I'll do my 5-year obligation and then think about, well, not just think about, but go to law school. Now, a lot of junior officers who do end up getting an interest or developing an interest in a law will do what they call the funded law education program, which is a program that allows you to branch transfer away from whatever branch of the Army you're in and become a JAG officer. And of course, the military will pay for your schooling, but then you obviously owe the Army however many years it turns
more
out
time
to be.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really have interest in doing that because I wanted more career flexibility and you know, to be frank about it, I just kind of like politics, and I wanted to get you know, fight for the things that I believed in politically. And that's just not something that you can do through the military. The military is an apolitical place. It's not really a place for partisans. And I just had a sense that, I wanted to pursue that sort of thing.
So what would you say? Would you have said at that time, what would it mean to fight for the things that you believed in? At least, I mean, because that may have evolved over time, but when you were heading to law school, what did you think that meant?
Well, I mean, the standard conservative, I think, view of the world. I've always been culturally conservative. So on social issues, I've always been a staunch conservative, you know, pro-life, wanting a more conservative culture, pro-family, you know, all those sorts of things. And, you know, at the time, especially when I was a junior officer in the Army, I'd go out to the field, read, you know, faithfully read my National Review, you know, when I had some downtime. So I was very much a conservative in that vein, mm-hmm. Socially conservative, economically pro free markets, you know, pro free enterprise, you know, let's whittle down the government to size, mm-hmm. Return, you know, power back to the states, those sort of standard conservative mm-hmm. views.
Mm-hmm. And then after law school, you had a series of clerkships, including Justice Alito. So what was that like?
Well, that was an incredible honor, obviously. And to this day, I feel like I was an Army affirmative action pick or something. I feel like I never really felt like I deserved it. But I was fortunate nonetheless to have that great opportunity. And of course, you know, I think he is a model judge. And between him and Justice Thomas, you know, those are the justices that everybody who considers themselves to be jurisprudentially conservative, you know, should be looking to, in my mind. That is the standard. Those two individuals are the standard.
Were there any ideas or sort of clarifying concepts, experiences that you had there that you?
Well, one thing that that struck me about some of his decisions when I first clerked, you know, this was a couple years after Snyder versus Phelps and the Stevens case, where Justice Alito was kind of by himself on some of these First Amendment questions.
Can you explain what those?
And well, Snyder versus Phelps was, you know, about the was whether or not a tort action could be brought against, well, I can't remember the name of the organization. It was an organization that would protest
right.
Service members' funerals.
Yeah.
And so the question is whether or not a tort could be brought against them for their speech activities, mm-hmm. causing obviously great emotional distress to the families. Mm-hmm. And the court ultimately held that no, those activities were protected, and Justice Alito disagreed and thought that the plaintiff should at least be able to bring their tort claim. But I think it just revealed, you know, that he had a more restrained and nuanced view of the scope of the First Amendment than really all of his other colleagues mm-hmm. did. Same thing with Stevens. Stevens was about a federal law that prohibited these crush videos. You know, I guess people will make videos of, you know, crushing the it's terrible heads mm-hmm. of little kittens or mm-hmm. Animals. And you know, he would have upheld that law and not struck it down. The rest of the court don't wanted to strike it down. So to me, that really appealed to me, because while I obviously believe in the First Amendment, I do believe there are limits right. to it. And that there are moral limits to it. And that's grounded, I think, in a proper understanding of the free speech clause.
Right. Historically grounded.
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, well, you know, it's just, so Abraham Lincoln talks about, right, there's not, you don't have a right to do a wrong. So if these rights are grounded in the natural law mm-hmm. and in natural rights, mm-hmm. then that means there has to be natural law limits to the rights. Because the rights and obligations come from the same place. the moral law, the natural law.
Right, right. So the difference maybe between having the scope of the protection as having sort of substantive moral content and limits as opposed to the sort of the more abstract.
Absolutely. And look, you can find a lot of this, of course, mm-hmm. by doing historical analysis, because I think this is the way our framers thought. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But the idea that it's completely freewheeling is just not correct.
But and I think there's some scholarship done that's been done more recently. Judd Campbell, we've talked about.
Yeah,
but at the time, Justice Alito was quite a bit ahead of the curve.
I think
so. On that thinking, probably.
And he still might be too far ahead of the curve, I think, relative to his colleagues. But this is an area that I think needs, you know, rethinking. I think we just instinctively want to think that, you know, the First Amendment, this expansive thing, and it is a very broad thing. Don't get me wrong. I'm not suggesting it's a narrow right. It is a meaningful right, but there are limits. And unfortunately, increasingly in our society, we're incapable of identifying limits and drawing lines. Right. And I think it requires just more intellectual and philosophical thought on our part to figure this out. And that means, I think, re-engaging with, you know, a tradition that has existed in the past, but I think that we've lost sight of.
Yeah. So after... after your clerkship experiences, you went to Jones Day?
Yeah, so when I graduated from law school, my first clerkship was with Judge Edmondson, who was the chief judge of the 11th Circuit at the time in Atlanta. I did that, and then I went to Jones Day for a year. I kept bouncing between clerkships and
sure.
Jones Day.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, in between clerkships, I went to Jones Day. After my 11th Circuit clerkship, went to Jones Day, then went to clerk for Judge Leon, mm-hmm. who's a federal district judge here in the District of Columbia. And then after that, went back to Jones Day for another year. That's actually interesting. I left D.C. altogether and went to Texas.
Mm-hmm.
D.C. was kind of grating on me by then, and my wife and I were itching to get back west. So we actually left D.C., went back and worked at the Jones Day office in Dallas. But what's interesting about that is Judge Leon was an important backer of mine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I told him, and he, you know, he was, I wouldn't have even applied to Justice Alito but for Judge Leon. He's
uh-huh.
the one who encouraged me. He's the one that really pushed me to do this. But I remember telling him, I said, look, Judge, I'll apply because you're asking me to. Well, my wife and I are going back to Texas. And I just remember him kind of shrugging his shoulders and saying, okay, you can go back. Mm-hmm. And so I went back, started at Jones Day. I was probably on the job for maybe 2 months and got a call to go interview with the justice. And then, you know, a month or two later, I actually had the job, walked back in the managing partner's office and said, I know I just got here, but I hope you'll forgive me. I got a clerkship with Justice Alito, so that brought me back to Washington, D.C. Then I did that and then went back to Jones Day again, but stayed here.
In D.C.
this time.
Got it.
Stay here at that time, yeah.
Right. And what kind of work were you doing at Jones Day?
So I was in the Issues and Appeals practice, mm-hmm. at least for that last round,
mm-hmm.
And had great experiences there working, you know, doing some legal work on the Detroit bankruptcy. And mm-hmm. of course, the big thing that I did that year, and of course, I know we have common friend in James Burnham. We were on the same trial team that defended Governor McDonnell in his public corruption prosecution by the Department of Justice. And I don't know, maybe I was bad luck there because I was on the trial team. He unfortunately lost. We always felt very strongly that he was legally innocent as a matter of
mm-hmm.
law.
Mm-hmm.
We just couldn't get the trial judge to see that. But it's very difficult to kick a criminal case on the front end. It's very
mm-hmm.
difficult to, you know, prevail
right.
on a motion to dismiss or something.
Mm-hmm.
But our whole case really did boil down to, you know, a question of law, a pure question of law. But because it's very difficult to get courts to take that up,
right.
you know, you got to go through the whole trial.
Right.
And of course he did, and was found guilty. And then soon after that, I got an opportunity to move on to work for Senator Cruz while the case was making its way up through mm-hmm. the appellate courts, but lost in the Fourth Circuit, but ultimately prevailed with a unanimous decision. And the Supreme Court was fortunate enough to go hear the argument, and Nolf Francisco handled that, and that was just a wonderful experience. And it was great to, you know, see our position vindicated in the end.
Right. And then, I guess at some point, you transitioned into the Trump administration.
So after Jones Day, I went mm-hmm. to work for Senator Cruz for two yep. years. Mm-hmm. And that was an interesting experience because, well, I was on his Senate staff, mm-hmm. so I was his chief counsel. But it was during that two-year period that he ran for president. So this was this was 2015, mm-hmm. 2016, mm-hmm. which was an incredible experience. And of course, he's an incredible boss and a great mm-hmm. legal mind in its own right. So it was a great honor, obviously, to work for him. And it was just an interesting experience to be on the Hill working for him when he was running for president. It was a interesting time, especially that first year, 2015. He's gearing up for his run. Not just gearing up, but I think he announced as early as March mm-hmm. of 2015. But because there's less, time on the campaign trail, he was still mm-hmm. back, on the floor in the Senate,
stuff.
Doing his thing as a senator for 2015. Mm-hmm. But that put a lot of pressure on us because he was the subcommittee chair on the Judiciary Committee mm-hmm. for the oversight, federal rights, federal courts subcommittee. And so he put a lot of pressure on us to organize hearings, mm-hmm. do a lot of hearings. So I think we cranked out more hearings as a subcommittee than any other wow. subcommittee in the Judiciary Committee that year. We're pretty proud of that. But it was a hectic time, and he would, come in, do his thing, and then move on to the next event. It was amazing to see him operate. And then, of course, once we sort of turned into 2016,
right?
He was out on the campaign trail a lot, but the business of the, mm-hmm. of the committee and the Senate still moved on. But that was a great experience. But I did do that for two mm-hmm. years before moving on to the Trump administration, which is an interesting,
yes,
which is an interesting turn of events in its of itself, because obviously, Senator Cruz was.
Right.
An opponent of yep. Donald Trump. And of course, everybody remembers, Senator Cruz's speech at the convention.
Yep.
but what was interesting, but when he came back and President Trump won, mm-hmm. the senator actually brought me into his office and said, while he would like me to stay if I wanted to, mm-hmm. he actually encouraged me mm-hmm. to go into mm-hmm. the administration, right. which I thought was a remarkable thing for him to do, especially after what he yep. had just
fairly
been through.
Selfless, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. And, yeah. I think at the time, I think there were still a lot of questions about, how conservative, President Trump would be in office and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But I think he wanted me to get the experience and to be a part of the administration and to move the ball forward. And so, yeah, he very much encouraged me to make the jump, because at that time I was very uncertain whether that was something I wanted to do. But once he encouraged me, and once I realized that a lot of great friends of mine who I trusted and knew were solid people mm-hmm. were going into the administration, I decided to go as well.
Yeah, it's an interesting, I think we've seen it, and we saw it after people, after the administration and people are leaving to go back to sort of other forms of employment, right? And it does seem like an interesting challenge where sort of on the one hand you have people questioning like how conservative is this president, but then on the other hand, like you will be president for 4 years and either sort of the question of who staffs that administration, right, is a pretty important one.
I learned as a lot of people did some mm-hmm. hard political lessons, mm-hmm. you know, at the time, mm-hmm. because especially those who are more intellectually minded about and philosophically minded about mm-hmm. things, you know, you want to be a purist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a natural tendency to just, mm-hmm. you know, want things to be perfect. And the reality is, in a you know, big, diverse, bustling country like ours, it just doesn't work that way. It's a massive country. Millions yeah. and millions of people think very differently, right? And at the end of the day, it's a two-party system. We have, you know, we have nominees of two parties, and mm-hmm. you got to pick a side. You know, right. you got to pick a team, right. and you know, who the winner may not, you know, be who you would have preferred. But that's how the system works, and you know, so you got a duty to go and help, you know, help your side. Right. Move the ball forward.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I mean, it was, of course, sort of even apart from kind of how conservative, it not a conventional Republican administration in a lot of ways by the standards of prior Republican administrations.
Not by any stretch. which is also a learning point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I mean, the difference between Donald Trump and Mitt Romney, who was the party's nominee, you know,
prior cycle,
that's a massive gulf, obviously.
Right.
And, you know, you had the Tea Party movement, obviously, in 2010, and Senator Cruz rode that movement, mm-hmm. you know, into office, basically coming out of nowhere to beat some very powerful political figures mm-hmm. in the state of Texas, riding that movement. But I even think, to a certain extent, even Senator Cruz kind of misread the nature of the movement. Mm-hmm. We thought it was a more libertarian kind of movement, get the government off our backs kind of movement. And there's certainly an element of that, obviously, the resistance mm-hmm. to Obamacare and everything.
Sure.
But I think what it turned out to be was a more populist movement mm-hmm. than a libertarian movement. And that's why I think, in the end, you know, Donald Trump was pushing those ideas in ways that his opponents were not. And I know that Senator Sessions and the president had a falling out, but, you know, Senator Sessions was the first U.S. senator to support and endorse Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And Senator Sessions in the Senate sort of embodied this populist mindset. And I think what I mean by that is, at least as a policy matter,
mm-hmm.
is tough on crime,
mm-hmm.
Skeptical of free trade
mm-hmm.
and the damage that it's done to the working class in the country. Very focused on immigration and limiting immigration into the country. And then cultural conservatism
mm-hmm.
and social issues. And then, of course, a more restrained foreign policy. It's not to say an isolationist foreign policy, but a foreign policy that's focused less on, you know, pursuing idealistic goals and much more focused on the hard realities of what's in our country's interests and what are we capable of, you know, actually accomplishing in a very different, in a very difficult global environment.
Right.
And, you know, I think President Trump was the first to really push on some of those issues. In a lot of ways, it really is, I think, the fruition of what Patrick Buchanan tried to accomplish back in the early 90s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so to go back when you mentioned, you know, where I was
mm-hmm.
back when I was in high school and Hobbs, New Mexico in 1992. Well, of course, that you know, that election also featured, you know, kind of an unusual candidate, Ross Perot.
Right.
captured the minds of a significant portion of the Republican base with, you know, his various concerns that weren't being addressed, you know, by mainstream establishment politicians mm-hmm. at the time. But then following that in 1996, you know, you had Patrick Buchanan, who was making all of these same points, you know, that immigration's a problem, global free trade is a problem or a potential problem, you know, and we need a restrained foreign policy. And oh, by the way, we need to get back to our cultural roots in this country in terms of, you know, social policy and so forth. And of course, that was the road, that was the path not taken at the time. Mm-hmm. But I do think it ultimately manifested itself in the election of Donald Trump. And of course, Senator Sessions at the time, you know, he was the senator who, you know, was beating these drums mm-hmm. repeatedly, you know, on the Senate floor. And while Senator Cruz had a lot in common with Senator Sessions, and they were aligned on a lot of issues in the Judiciary Committee. In fact, my closest, you know, friends in terms of other Senate staffers, you know, were Senator Sessions' staff. We worked together very closely on many things. But Senator Sessions really embodied that. And I think, you know, Senator Cruz has seen the value in all that as well and has moved in that direction. Mm-hmm. But I do think it was a sort of misdiagnosis of mm-hmm. where that Tea Party movement really was, that I think maybe hurt Senator Cruz and gave mm-hmm. President Trump a bit of an advantage in the 2016 election.
So there were some who have said, I guess, that is not really a conservative policy platform. And I'm not really sure how useful it is to sort of chase down the sort of the scope and content of labels, but it mm-hmm. for a lot of the intra-right policy debates, right? There is some discussion on the merits of the policy, but a lot you wind up, I think, hear it focused on so the question of whether something is or is not conservative, right? So what, any thoughts on whether you want to call it conservative or just sort of whatever label you want for your kind of legal and political philosophies? Like, what would you say are the essential elements that...
Well, I think the person who has best defined what conservatism really is, and I'm not going to be able to do him justice, but is Russell Kirk. And if you go back and read his work, he laid out 6 or 10 principles of conservatism, which I think really influenced me. In fact, his book, The Conservative Mind, mm-hmm. which I'm sure you're familiar with, really spoke to me in a profound way when I first read it, because I thought, yeah, that makes sense to me, right? Conservatism is not just a set of policy prescriptions, but it really is a way of looking at the world. And
maybe the rare book that stands the test of time in terms of
that's right. How I the think world it was just changed. Even some reason. You know, I mean, it's I can't remember. I'd written in 1955 or something like that. So mm-hmm. it is a great book. But he walks through a number of principles that I think encapsulate what conservatism is, and I think you can extrapolate from those. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, what policies you should be pursuing. Mm-hmm. You know, at a given time. But like preserving the moral order, for instance, a belief mm-hmm. in the transcendent, you know, these are, mm-hmm. right, mm-hmm. I think a key component of what it means to be a conservative, a respect for, you know, the diversity of people.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, so because he was, yeah, because, he, you know, this, of course, he was writing at a time in which, you know, the trend was toward socialistic uniformity, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think conservatism does value the natural diversity of human societies. And I think that's why there's a tendency to favor the local,
mm-hmm.
you know, over the, you know, over the national
mm-hmm.
in conservative thought. So I do think that's a key element of it.
So then transitioning to your move to the DeSantis administration, and again, a lot of new policy ideas that not just no one had done before, but like maybe not had even thought seriously about being able to do before. And some of that disagreement within the right, some criticism that it's authoritarian, it's big government conservatism, it's contrary to true conservative principles. And just so that we're not kind of just back and forth on abstractions, I remember mm-hmm. one of the early decisions, fairly early in the COVID era, that set the DeSantis administration apart was what to do about the vaccine mandates. And you came onto a webinar that the Freedom of Thought Project did that kind of canvassed the lay of the land. And I think we had, there was someone who had published sort of the libertarian case for federal government vaccine mandates. and then you had some middle ground about, well, maybe the federal government shouldn't do it, but maybe there's like a sort of a federalism thing where sort of states can mandate the vaccines, right? I think there was the largest consensus was, I think, on the idea that government should stay out, but like just leave it to the private sector, right? And let people vote with their feet and vote with their dollars, right? I think there was this idea that if people really didn't like the vaccine mandates, like the local hardware store would sort of scale up and challenge Home Depot, and I think that came up on the program. The DeSantis administration was really quite an outlier, as I recall, in just a straight up ban, just sort of for the purposes of the state of Florida, we will not permit a vaccine mandate. And so with that maybe as a sort of as an interesting concrete example, sort of what's the thinking of how that fits in this conservative philosophical framework?
Well, sometimes I think we focus too much on proceduralism. Mm-hmm. And so we do, I think, have a tendency to want to talk in abstractions, right? Well, what's the appropriate scope of liberty? What's appropriate scope of government, you know, in the abstract, as if there is ever a clean answer to that. I'm not sure that there necessarily is. That's why I think we live in a republic. We vote on things. We elect leaders to exercise judgment. And so I want to kind of start there, because one of the reasons that I went to Florida is because I was impressed by the way that the governor handled the COVID crisis. In emergencies, that's typically when the government has its, a widest sway, and especially the executive, in an emergency, right? But that requires exercising good judgment. And unfortunately, that's in, lower and lower supply these days. But one of the things that really impressed me about the governor was he didn't just do what everybody else was doing. And there's a natural tendency, especially for politicians who are naturally, I think, risk averse, to just follow the herd. What are other governors doing? What is the president telling me to do? Yep. What are all these CDC experts telling me to do? And I'll just do that. Governor DeSantis did not do that. He looked at the evidence himself independently, obviously with the advice of others. Mm-hmm. But he didn't just stop there in terms of looking at, all right, well, it's COVID and our number one task is to, stop the spread of the disease. Because he had to examine, well, to do that, what will be the impact in other areas of life that are also important, right? How will it affect other interests that are very important? Right, that is not something a doctor can tell you. Like, Fauci is not going to tell you, how you should address schools or, keep the economy going. All he's going to say is, lockdowns and masks, because that's what will stop the spread. Well, people in leadership positions can't stop there. They have to consider the consequences of that. In other words, they have to balance competing interests. And I think that's what the governor did to better effect than any other leader at the time. And I think that's why he's been credited for having a successful response to the COVID crisis. But once he did his homework mm-hmm. and realized that a lot of the things that were being pushed about the vaccines and about COVID itself were not necessarily accurate. Mm-hmm. And then the oppressiveness with which the medical community and the public health establishment was, you know, forcing this upon everyone, his inclination, given the state of play, was to protect people and to let them make decisions for themselves as to whether or not they're going to take that vaccine or not. And to not allow, whether it be public authorities or whether it be a person's employer, make the decision for them at the end of the day. And so he came in strong for choice, giving people the choice, especially given all of the circumstances that existed at the time and the state of knowledge with respect to these vaccines, which were cooked up in breakneck pace. And so I think he just, in a fundamental way, like, that's what it means to be a good leader. Mm-hmm. And in a way, that's what it means to be a conservative leader, right? Like, let's really look at the state of knowledge at the time. Mm-hmm. Let's balance all the competing interests. Let's take them all into account and exercise measured judgment. Not get swept away by ideology or by experts, you know, and what they're saying and so forth. And so I think he embodies in that crisis, he was the model of a true statesman and political leader.
Interesting. So we're going to take a break and we will be back to focus on, to bring this sort of philosophical framework and apply to the present situation. So thank
Excellent.
You so much, Brian.